This is Jeff Spittler, February 17th, 2002, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, number 58, The Aftermath of William Green. Okay, last week we covered, perhaps ad nauseum, the ratcheting up of persecution of the nonconformist covenanters. The persecution had its basis in a law of sorts, or laws of sorts, such as the bishop's dragnet. A new commission to enforce ecclesiastical conformity was run by Archbishop Sharp and had unlimited powers. And we also saw how it was used to arbitrarily punish committed covenanters. The military was used to persecute people with all manner of extortion and other outrages. And it'll get worse, don't worry. And finally, the people had had enough and took to arms. However, they were defeated by a larger, better equipped, and better trained force at William Green, just south of Edinburgh, on the 28th of November, 1666. So, Mike, that's your short summary of what happened. As one might imagine, and in particular with Archbishop Sharp in charge, things did not go well for the prisoners and those caught after the battle. Obviously, the prisoners at the battle, and there were other fugitives caught, you know, afterwards in the following days. The council immediately asked approval of the king for a policy of extirpation and proclaimed harboring of any of the 57 supposed leaders to be treason. Hewison mentions a list of names, including McClellan of Barscob, the guy who started part of this by capturing the party of soldiers. Let's see. Oh, also many others. He lists those names and many others who were not concerned in the affair. And one suspects they weren't being too particular about whether or not they got the right people. The Earl of Ross rushed back from London, and the king appointed a judicial commission consisting of nobles, barons, and officers to itinerate and try the rebels. Delisle's men captured two prisoners, Hugh McHale and a man who was a lay elder, Nielsen of Corsac, who they thought could divulge everything if they were just induced to do so. John Nelson of Corsac had given shelter to two of the field preachers, Welsh and Semple. He'd allowed them to preach in his house. For that, he'd been thrown in the Kirkcaldy jail. He had his house turned into a cavalry barracks. He was fined £2,000 Scots and made a bankrupt wanderer. His wife and family were evicted by the soldiers who sold off his livestock. Yet, he had been the one who had offered Sir James Turner quarter when they captured him, and when one Andrew Gray wished to shoot Sir James Turner on the spot, of course, intervened and said no, he'd given him quarter, and they couldn't shoot him. And Turner survived, unlike many of the Covenanters who were given a quarter, who were executed. Let's see. Nielsen was first tortured with the iron boot, and then he was sentenced to death on the 14th of December, along and also sentenced to be dismembered and forfeited and so on. And I found, to explain what the torture of the boot is, I found this little footnote in this book by Gilbert Burnett. The torture of the boots in Scotland is when they put a pair of iron boots close on the legs and then drive wedges between them, that is, between the boots and the legs. The common way is to drive them at the calf of the leg, but in some cases they're driven upon the shin bone. They use a heavy mallet to do it, and it tears apart muscle and breaks bones, shatters your leg. Nielsen's wife and six children, including a baby, were turned out of the house. His eldest son was in exile, and another son was in jail for church going. Okay, about Hugh McHale. Let's see, just a few words about him. He was born about 1640, was educated at the University of Edinburgh. In the winter of 1661, he offered himself for trials in the ministry before the Presbytery of Edinburgh, and being by them licensed, he preached several times with great acceptance. Okay, shortly thereafter, they started to evict the ministers, so he, in his case, he preached his last public sermon from Canticles 1:7 in the High Church of Edinburgh upon the Sabbath immediately preceding the 8th of September 1662, the day fixed by Parliament for the removal of the ministers of Edinburgh. In this sermon, taking occasion to speak of the great and many persecutions to which the Church of God had been and was subjected, and amplifying the point from the persons and powers that had been instrumental therein, he said that the Church and people of God had been persecuted by a Pharaoh upon the throne, a Haman in the state, and a Judas in the church. And these characters seem so similar to those of the rulers of church and state at that time that though he made no particular application, he was reputed guilty. So I think you can pretty much figure that the Pharaoh upon the throne was Charles, and the Judas in the church was Archbishop Sharp, and probably the Haman in the state was, you could pick your cast of characters who might have fit that bill. So he was sent to be apprehended, and he escaped, but then he spent 4 years, I think some of it, he may have been out of the country, but he spent 4 years sort of wandering and hiding out. When the troubles arose in the West, he went out west, and he did march with the troops that were heading towards Edinburgh at the Pentland Rising at William Green that we discussed last week. He was forced a day or so before the battle to drop out by fatigue and ill health, and he was captured the day after the battle. And a little bit of an account, again, from the Scotsworthies. He was brought to Edinburgh, first to the town council house, where he was searched for letters, but none being found, he was committed prisoner to the Tolbooth. Upon Wednesday the 28th, he was, by order of the secret council, brought before the Earl of Dumfries, Lord Sinclair, Sir Robert Murray of Priestfield, and others, in order to his examination. Being interrogated concerning his joining the Westland forces, he, conceiving himself not obliged by any law or reason to be his own accuser, did decline the question. After some reasoning, he was desired to subscribe his name, but refused. And this fact, when reported to the council, gave them great offense and brought him under suspicion of being a dissembler. That's a liar. On the 29th, he was again called, when, to allay this prejudice, he gave in a declaration under his own hand, testifying that he had been with the Westland forces. Though it was certainly known that he had both formed and subscribed this acknowledgement the night before, yet they still persisted in their jealousy. Suspecting him to have been privy to all the designs of that party, they dealt with him with the greater importunity to declare an account of the whole business. And upon December 3rd, the boots, a most terrible instrument of torture, were laid on the council house table before him. He was certified that if he would not confess, he would be tortured the next day. Accordingly, he was called before them, and being urged to confess, he solemnly declared that he knew no more than what he had already confessed, whereupon they ordered the executioner to put his leg in the boots and to proceed to the torture to the number of 10 or 11 strokes with considerable intervals, yet all did not move him to express any impatience or bitterness. This torture was the cause of his not being indicted with the first 10, who were arraigned and sentenced on Wednesday, December 5th, to be hanged on the Friday following. Many thought that his slight connection with the Rising and what he had suffered by torture should have procured him some favor, but it was otherwise determined, for his former sermon was not forgotten, especially the words of Pharaoh upon his throne, etc. Okay. There's a lengthy account in here of his sentencing and his last, dinner, where he cheered his fellow prisoners to be executed the next day, and his speech on the scaffold and so on. A little bit more about the judicial proceedings. On the 16th of December, he, being indifferently recovered, was with other three brought before the justices, where the general indictment was read, founded both on old and recent acts of Parliament, made against rising in arms, entering into leagues and covenants, and renewing the solemn league and covenant without and against the king's authority. Hugh McHale was particularly charged with joining the rebels at Ayr, Ochiltree, Lanark, and other places on horseback. Hereupon, being permitted to answer, he spoke in his own defense, both concerning the charge laid against him, and likewise of the tithes and obligations that were upon this land to God, commending the institution, dignity, and blessing of Presbyterian government, and said that the last words of the national covenant had always had a great weight on his spirit. Here he was interrupted by the king's advocate, who bade him forbear that discourse and answer the question for the crime of rebellion. To this he answered that the thing which moved him to declare as he had done was that weighty important saying of our Lord Jesus, "Whosoever shall confess me before men, him shall the Son of Man also confess before the angels of God." After the depositions of those examined anent him were read, with his replies to the same, the assize was enclosed, after which they gave their verdict unanimously, and by the mouth of Sir William Murray, their chancellor, reported him guilty. This being done, doom was pronounced, declaring and adjudging him and the rest to be taken on Saturday, December 20th, to the Market Cross of Edinburgh, there to be hanged on a gibbet till dead, and their goods and lands to be escheated and forfeited for His Highness's use. Anyway, so you should read the rest of it. It's interesting and quite impressive. The executions continued at least until the 20th or 22nd of December. By two different accounts, the king had sent a letter to order that the executions be stopped. And one or the other of the archbishops is reported to have held on to the letter until after Hugh MacHale was executed. Burnett, again, Episcopalian writer, said the outcry against MacHale's death became more popular when it was afterwards known that Archbishop Burnett, who has come down before his execution, in other words, came up from London, but had brought with him a letter from the king prohibiting any further effusion of blood and ordering such as would conform the government should be discharged and the incorrigible sent to plantations, which letter he never produced until the execution was over. Okay. Let's see. Of course, the other prisoners were also executed. I sort of got out of order here, but the Hewison's account, lest the wounded might die, batches of them were brought to trial in the Justiciary Court in Edinburgh. The first on the 5th of December, Nisbet being the prosecutor and Lockhart and Mackenzie being the counsel of defense. The indictment bore that the prisoners were guilty of treason, rebellion, having lesse majestas. I don't know. Having taken Turner, plundered houses, renewed the covenant, and slain the king's soldiers. Their plea that they had received quarter was met by Nisbet's reply that there was no justum bellum. Others pleaded that had they known of the proclamation, they would have laid down their arms. All acknowledged participation in the rebellion. The assize all in one voice by the mouth of Sir Alexander Urquhart of Cromarty, their chancellor, and all and every one of the panels, found all and every one of the panels guilty. Let's see. Reads off a list of names who are guilty and they're to be taken Friday the 7th of December betwixt 2 and 4 hours afternoon to the Market Cross of Edinburgh, and they're to be hanged upon a gibbet till they be dead, and after they are dead their heads and right arms to be cut off and disposed upon as the Lords of the Majesty's Privy Council shall think fit, and all their lands, heritages, goods and gear to be forfeit and escheat to His Majesty's use for the treasonable crimes for said which was pronounced for doom. Okay, the 10 were simultaneously hanged on a huge cross tree and thereafter mutilated, the 10 right hands being sent for fixture on Lanark Tolbooth, the heads of the Gordons and McCulloch to Kirkcaldy, the heads of the Hamiltons, Parker and Strang to Hamilton, and so on. Okay. Let's see. So as you can imagine, besides the actual treatment of the prisoners, powers to be wanted to get even with more people, so they once renewed their quartering of troops and the like. And Burnett says, after the suppression of this rebellion, the forces were ordered to lie in the west, where Dalisle acted the Muscovite too grossly and committed many monstrous barbarities. Some he threatened to spit and roast alive, others he killed in cold blood, or rather in hot, for he was almost always drunk. And those who refused to come to church, he used to quarter so many soldiers upon as were enough to eat them up in one night. By this means a terror was struck into the country, and people began to come regularly to church for fear. This delighted the clergy highly, who, looking upon the soldiery as, in this respect, their best patrons, were not a little solicitous to be constantly in their company, and not at all ashamed to run with them into all riots and excess, if not to go before them in some gross instances of wickedness and immorality. Episcopalian writer, again. One other anecdote about the subjugation of the West. let's see, referring to Delisle, he caused David Finlay and Newmills to be taken and examined as to his business in Lanark on that day on which the rebels visited it. And because he could not name these strangers, he ordered a party to shoot him at the gallows foot. The simple man, thinking that the goat-like monster was jesting, prevailed on the lieutenant to return to ask Delisle for respite till morning. Delisle, in a rage, threatened the officer, declaring that, quote, he would teach him to obey his orders precisely. The lieutenant accordingly ordered the soldiers to shoot and strip this unoffending man. Okay, for having been in Lanark on the same day and not knowing anything. Following August, the trial was held for 56 men in absentia. Since they didn't turn themselves in, they were all condemned to death. Okay, 1667 brought many changes in England as well as Scotland. Previously in England, several thousand ministers had been ejected from their churches. The Earl of Clarendon, Charles's Lord High Chancellor, fell out of favor with the king and lost his office. Clarendon had been a supporter of highly intolerant episcopacy in England, and as well as Sharp's policies in Scotland. Lauderdale, on the other hand, had advocated a more tolerant policy, and he would now have a better chance of getting the king to listen. As Burnett said, the government, which ran all in favor of the church party before, began to put on another aspect. Bridgman, who succeeded to the seals, in other words, as Lord High Chancellor, was a person of great integrity and had serious impressions of religion on his mind. He was always on the side of the church, but had a great tenderness for the nonconformists. The Duke of Buckingham, since Lord Clarendon's fall, was received into great favor and set up for a patron of liberty of conscience. Bridgman and one of the moderate bishops, the Bishop of Chester, Simon Rees's hometown, tried to get a more moderate policy in place that would allow some of the English ministers to be readmitted to the ministry. And a similar but ultimately unsuccessful attempt would be made in Scotland. Okay, I mentioned, I think, 3 weeks ago that Lauderdale had a policy of what he called enough rope with Sharp. In other words, you give him enough rope and he would hang himself. It was on Sharp's watch that the Pentland Rising occurred, despite the fact that the Earl of Ross was at that very moment in London reporting that everything was well. Furthermore, reports were filtering back to London of the vindictiveness of Sharp and how the country was set against him. And when there was a meeting of the estates, called sometimes this, you know, Parliament, Privy Council, Estates, it all gets kind of confusing, but the estates in this case were called a special convention for the purpose of raising funds via taxes. It was called by the king in January 1667. He made Hamilton the president instead of Sharp. Sharp had been the previous year's president. And what was far worse, Sharp was ordered to confine to his own diocese. According to Burnett, Sharp, under which slight disgrace he showed as much abjectness as he had insolence before when he was in favor. So, gossip ran that he was to be deposed, but Lauderdale, however, as Hewson says, knew how to make him obedient to the whip and still had a use for the primate who might keep the clergy from flying out to impertinencies. In March of 1667, a proclamation was made that called up the personal weapons and horses of non-churchgoers. And I mentioned that if you read our own Bill of Rights, that, you know, you could almost look at everything in there and say, this is, you know, this addresses this. Well, there you go, the Second Amendment. You knew I wouldn't let you down on that. Sir Robert Moray reported on the state of Scotland in July of 1667. This was an official report sent back to Lauderdale, the Secretary of State. Hewson characterized this, and I love this sentence, official light was rotten and smelled of liquor and dirt. And then Mary said, now let me tell you that all anybody can tell you of the corrupt state of things and persons here can as little make you imagine it as it is as one who never saw the ruins of London can comprehend by any description anybody can make of it. London had burned in 1666, the Great Fire. London thought at that time to be God's judgment on the king, partly for this Dutch war that he'd gotten himself into. He enlarged on his experiences to this effect. The rumor regarding mad fanatics about to rebel were false, quote, starlight stories. Officers were defrauding their men of pay. Hamilton, Delisle, and others were so mean on the one hand as to compound with rebels for a few merks, while on the other they illegally exacted £1,700 from Loudoun's tenantry. Ballantyne, I think this was Sir William Ballantyne, was a notorious spoiler, and Steele, Minister of Kells, had informed him that Turner, who beggared his parish so that parishioners were unable to pay a stipend, quote, was a saint compared to Ballantyne. The treasury was a den of robbers, etc. Okay, so with Moore's report, and he also made a proposal that those who subscribed a bond to be peaceful, they should receive pardon and indemnity. With that proposal, a new conciliatory policy was approved by Charles. And for those who had promised not to rise in arms without authority, and who would produce a cautioner, in other words, a monetary deposit like bail, before New Year's Day 1668, they would be pardoned and received indemnity for their past actions. There were three classes of people accepted: the 56 insurgents, presumably the ones who'd been sentenced to death, people already forfeited, and people who molested the intruded ministers. There was a problem at the time with these intruded ministers being robbed a lot. It's not necessarily by the Covenanters, but I mean, it was. There's criminals in every society, and some of them took advantage of the fact that they probably would be treated leniently or not fought too badly. Let's see. According to Hewison's view of this was that, I mean, a number of people refused to sign this bond. 218 subscribed, but there were 300 who refused. He says the hair-splitting Scots with tender consciousness read more into the surety of this of lawbearers than Moray intended, as if it bound them to the past and future policy of the crown. Others, Campbell, Dunlop, Montgomery, etc., welcomed it and got released from prison. Or Gilbert Burnett put it, the required bond was accounted a test so mild that all, except some melancholy superstitious persons, whose heads were always full of scruples, submitted to it. And a general satisfaction after this change and a great appearance of public tranquility were everywhere seen. It's true, even though not everyone signed it, there was certainly greater public tranquility. Another aspect of the conciliatory policy was that the Privy Council investigated the persecution campaigns of Turner. They met on the 20th of February 1668. They detailed his offenses under 21 different headings. His defense was that he had only lifted 30,000 pounds Scots and had always mitigated the severity authorized. The king ordered him to be discharged from the service. Ballantyne, one of the other officers, was sent to prison and then fined 200 pounds sterling and then banished from Scotland. In the spring of 1668, additional efforts went into getting more people to sign the bond and also to stop conventicling. According to Hewison, the Scots exiles in Holland, I presume he meant John Brown and Robert McWard, wrote against signing the bond. They sort of provided constant commentary and propaganda and so on back home to Scotland, so I'm assuming that's who he's talking about. In May, a warrant was issued to seize 80 people who refused to sign the bond, and some were sent to Virginia and others to Tangier. A special commission of the king also investigated abuses of the clergy. And according to Burnett, the ministers wouldn't accuse each other. They were sort of had a guild of thieves or whatever sort of mentality. And the people wouldn't complain to the bishop because they felt that by doing so, they would be recognizing the bishop's authority. Okay, but even though there's a policy was somewhat conciliatory, it was also anti-conventicling, and conventicling spread even in Edinburgh, and the clergy, in other words, the intruded clergy, were more despised than ever. Burnett's explanation is that people felt empowered. That's my word, not his. Obviously, that would be anachronistic for him to use to say people were empowered. But by the relaxation of persecution and by the investigation of the clergy. And so they now more frequently absented themselves from churches, and hence the rise in conventicling. In July of 1668, there was the first attempt on Archbishop Sharp's life. And this is the kind of thing we all like to hear about, you know, attempted assassinations and so on. According to Hewson, the strain of the times was too much for the ill-nourished mind of James Mitchell, quote, a stickit minister. This term stickit minister comes up, and it's a sort of a Scots term. If I remember right, it's somebody who doesn't have a proper ordination by presbytery. So he may have had some kind of field presbytery ordination or something like that. But a poor student from the Lothians, he graduated at Edinburgh, and doubtless the spare diet of a private tutor and chaplain made him a lean, hollow-cheeked man of truculent countenance. Robert Blair, minister of Edinburgh, confidently recommended this honest young man in 1661 as fit to be a teacher or a precentor. He subscribed both covenants when demanded by Principal Leighton, but unlike the principal, kept them. Okay, Leighton was a bishop, when he was a Presbyterian, he had forced people to take the covenants before communion and so on, but then he went back on his word, became a bishop. Let's see. With Alexander Henderson, he held that the bishops were the makers of the nation's woes. Believing Sharp to be the instigator of all the sufferings of the time, he imagined he had a call to remove him. He joined the insurgents and was sent to Edinburgh to interview Stirling, the author of Naphtali and Ferguson of Kaitlock. Thereafter, he skulked about under the name of James Small, armed with two loaded Scots pistols. Sharp's mansion was on the high street of Edinburgh, between the Netherbow and Blackfriars Wynd. On Saturday afternoon, 11th July, Mitchell, lurking on the north side of the high street, saw Sharp, followed by Honeyman, Bishop of Orkney, entering the primate's coach. Mitchell fired through the window, but being, quote, an ill gunner, missed Sharp and shattered Honeyman's wrist resting on the door of the carriage. Clearing away with the second pistol, Mitchell dived into the wind, up Cowgate, into Ferguson's house in Stephen Law's clothes, where he removed his disguise before descending to the street to join in the hue and cry, from which he sought retirement, it is said, in the very toll booth. The cry, "A man killed," was soon hushed by the report, "'twas only a bishop." Mitchell was not suspected and escaped. Sharp, however, got a glimpse of that mummified face beneath the odd periwig, which haunted for years till he identified it again at Robert Douglas's funeral and had Mitchell apprehended. Sharp was scared out of his wits, and as you might expect, this had certain after effects. All the potential suspects were brought in for questioning. Some were kept in prison for months, etc. The usual sort of totalitarian response to guerrilla warfare. So Gilbert Burnett, who until now has sort of been on the sidelines commenting on history, and we find his commentary pretty useful because he writes from the Episcopal point of view, and if he says the Episcopal ministers were bad, he's not just making it up to smear them. He now appears on stage as one of the actors. He came up with the idea of settling, quote, moderate Presbyterians into vacant churches. And after some discussion, this idea was passed on to the king, who approved it by an order to the Privy Council on the 7th of June, 1669. This was what became known as the First Indulgence. Okay, the indulgence provided for parish ministers resuming duty in their charges when vacant. In other parishes, when presented to them by patrons, in consideration of being orderly, receiving collation, allowing ecclesiastical or attending ecclesiastical courts, and receiving full emoluments. Refusers of collation, so you could refuse to be approved by the bishop, you were still allowed the use of the manse and glebe. That's the land surrounding the parsonage, and all were to attend the Presbyterian courts and restrict their services to their own parishes. The offer of an indulgence was only to those ministers who had lived peaceably and not done any field preaching or any other sort of anti-government activity like marching with the rebels. In addition, they were to stay away from current events in their preaching, and they were not to approve of visitors from other parishes, or they weren't to have this system where, you know, like William Guthrie of Fenwick, you know, he had all on Sabbaths, he would have all these other people coming in. Specifically, they also weren't supposed to baptize and give communion to these people. So, this to me is somewhat reminiscent of the engagement. It sounds like a, we'll say, reasonable compromise, reasonable being in quotes. I mean, especially if you have no fixed views about the government setting the terms for which ministers could serve in the churches. Charles, I'm sure, had no fixed views about that, except that he thought government should set the terms. Between the summer of 1669 and March of 1670, 42 ministers accepted the indulgence. Okay, but if you remember our numbers and the numbers rejected, that leaves about 300, give or take, that didn't accept the indulgence. As explained by Maurice Grant in his biography of Donald Cargill, this is No King But Christ. It's I think I ordered this from Amazon.com. He said, the indulgence thus ran counter to the principles of spiritual independence which lay at the heart of the Presbyterian system. It was natural that some ministers should seek relief from oppression and confinement by accepting it, but their compliance came to be regarded by others, under equal constraint, as a denial of the headship of Christ and a complicity with the enemies of the church. The indulgence thus came to be a subject of strong contention and the cause of many bitter controversies among those who until now have been of one mind and heart. John Brown, the exiled minister in the Netherlands, pointed out that this peaceable and orderly living as a qualification for being indulged included a negative or passive compliance with tyranny, oppression of the Kirk and country, bloodshed, apostasy, and persecution of conscientious people. This is the indulgence is important
well, there'll be a series of them, I think four or five altogether. It's important in the same way that the engagement was important. It split, really split the church. And later it even split the field preachers themselves, not over whether or not to accept the indulgence, because they were all against that, but whether or not they could have any sort of fellowship with ministers who had accepted the indulgence. Let's see. J.D. Douglas, in his book White in the North, makes a few comments on the indulgence that I thought were worthwhile. Let's see. The Covenanters generally were quick to recognize Lauderdale's offer, right? The King's offer made through Lauderdale, or no doubt by the advice of Lauderdale, as being the thin edge of the wedge. In this they were consistent, and both ministers and people, for the most part, regarded the offer as a snare of the evil one, an insidious way of getting souls to acknowledge prelacy unawares. A party catchword straight from the scripture, and therefore dear to the covenanting heart, was touch not, taste not, handle not. As it was, only 42 of the ministers yielded. They were promptly denounced as, quote, dumb dogs that could not bark, a description which finds a parallel in an English translation of George Buchanan's Baptistes, in which context it is not inappropriate to our present subject. Like dumb dogs that bark not, hear you fret and fume about your sheepcoats, but the wolves, which of you, drive away? The compliant ministers were known as also as the king's curates, as distinct from the bishop's curates, and their ministrations were disdainfully refused by most of the people. Acceptance of the indulgent meant virtually that the indulged constituted a little church within the church under the government of the state. Okay, one positive thing about the indulgence, I'll just view here, yet even the historian Wadra admits that, quote, the Lord had much good to bring out of it, i.e. the indulgence, to the famishing souls of thousands, and though the indulged ministers could not but acknowledge they had as a great and sensible assistance in the work of the gospel as ever they had known. He mentions a few of the indulged ministers, one of whom was Robert Douglas, five times moderator of the General Assembly and preacher at Charles II's coronation in Scotland. Deprived of his charge at Greyfriars 7 years earlier, Douglas, now at 75, became indulged minister at Pencaitland, where he remained till his death in February of 1674. Right, but Douglas had been one of the leading resolutioners. Burnett has a slightly less sanguine view. After explaining that the indulged ministers were given a set of rules for their behavior, he says, at first, the people of the country ran to them with a transport of joy. They were in hopes that they would have begun their ministry with a public testimony against all that was done in opposition to what they called the work of God. But when they found they were silent as to that particular and preached only the doctrines of Christianity, they soon changed their sentiments. With some severe invective against them as betrayers of their brethren and deserters of their principles for filthy lucre's sake, returned again to conventicles, although they endeavored to retain them by mean compliances and servile methods of popularity. Ironically, to my way of thinking, the indulgence was also strongly opposed by some of the episcopal hierarchy. What exactly their basis was, since they were completely just set up, you know, in an Erastian way by the government, I don't know. But in October, Archbishop Burnett and some of his curates under him wrote up a remonstrance, and they had planned to circulate this and get some more support, but a smuggled copy reached Lauderdale. And when he showed it to the king, Charles said, and I quote, this damned paper shows bishops and episcopal people are as bad in this chapter as the most errant Presbyterian or remonstrator. Okay. In Charles's letter to the Privy Council instructing them with regards to the indulgence, he closes with, and after you've seen how few accepted the indulgence, you'll see this is a bit strained. And seeing we have by these orders taken away all pretenses for conventicles and provided for the wants of such as are will be peaceable, if any shall be found hereafter to preach without authority or keep conventicles, our express pleasure is that you proceed with all severity against the preachers and hearers as seditious persons and contemners of our authority. If this is to be a recurring theme, so-called conciliatory measures were followed by harsh measures to all who were recalcitrant. I guess you could call it a carrot and stick policy. True, when Charles wrote, he may not have known how few ministers would accept the indulgence. But at that time already, the field preachers were sometimes, like Welsh, were sometimes preaching to crowds of over 1,000. So this wasn't just a few misguided souls who were out conventicling. Okay, the Earl of Rose was replaced by Lauderdale as the King's Commissioner to Parliament. Rose had been part of, I guess you could say, part of the Clarendon faction. He was demoted to Chancellor. In a new Scottish Parliament, which started to meet in October of 1669, the first order of business was the Explanatory Act, which spelled out the meaning of the Supremacy Act of 1661. And, let's see, quoting the Act, which starts out very similar to the Supremacy Act and then goes on to sort of fill in the details or make the claims a little clearer, His Majesty hath the supreme authority and supremacy over all persons and in all causes ecclesiastical within this kingdom. Okay, and at the time, the Supremacy Act, that was said, oh yes, but he would never interfere with the churches. And that by virtue thereof, the ordering and disposal of the external government and policy of the church doth properly belong to His Majesty and his successors as an inherent right to the crown. And that His Majesty and his successors may settle, enact, and emit such constitutions, acts, and orders concerning the administration of the external government of the church and the persons employed in the same, and concerning all ecclesiastical meetings and matters to be proposed and determined therein, as they in their royal wisdom shall think fit, which acts, orders, and constitutions are to be observed and obeyed by all His Majesty's subjects. Okay, now this, I mean, the obvious thing is that this makes clear that Charles is, in one sense, this has been his policy all along, you know, to be able to appoint people at will and to change anything he wants. It's what James wanted, certainly. It was, in the context of the times, also somewhat of a rebuke to those in the church who had opposed his latest, you know, his indulgences, specifically. And, let's see, Maurice Grant again puts gives us another view, which is nothing could be more comprehensive, nothing could mark out more plainly the absolute supremacy which the king now claimed over the church and over every aspect of its government. Here was the very negation of the Presbyterian system on which the Reformed Church of Scotland had been built. Here, to the Presbyterian, was the crown, absolute, dictatorial, arrogating to itself that complete control over the body of Christ to which only Christ, the head, had the lawful right. The words in the act, quote, as an inherent right to the crown, end quote, were particularly significant, since they plainly meant that to disown the king's authority in ecclesiastical matters was to disown him as a king, and thereby to be guilty of treason. They linked the ecclesiastical power inextricably with the civil, so that to deny the one was to deny the other. In this way, the seeds of the persecution which before long was to reach its full height. It hasn't gotten there yet. Many a royal Presbyterian could not bring himself to say the apparently innocuous words, God save the king, since to do so would be to acknowledge the king in the comprehensive extent of his power, ecclesiastical as well as civil, and to acquiesce in all the measures he had introduced in the exercise of that power, including the disowning of the covenants and the overturning of the work of reformation. To many, including Donald Cargill, refusal to bow to the claims of the royal authority as asserted in this act was to be the decisive test of loyalty to Christ and to carry with it the issues of life and death. Okay, he says, never had a pope such power. The covenanter said the act placed Charles as a pope on Christ's throne. He says Charles was to use it right away. He offered Archbishop Burnet the choice between early retirement and a pension, or else. And Burnet chose early retirement, and quoting Gilbert Burnet, no relation, he says, retiring to a private state of life bore his disgrace better than he had his honors. So, okay, well, we'll stop there about late fall of 1669, and so what we covered a few years today, so we're slowly getting there. Any questions?